Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello again, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another Motorsport Magazine podcast. And today is a very special one, for me anyway, because we are returning to the roots of Mr. Derek Bell. We are in his house on the Sussex coast. We're probably closer to France than we are to London. And this used to be real motor racing country back in the day, with John Watson living up the road, Mike Earle living up the road, all sorts of people.
Dave Purley.
David Purley. How could I forget David Purley? Anyway, I was going to say welcome, Derek, but you're welcoming us to your lovely house by the sea.
Yeah, it is fantastic that you came here. I wasn't sure until after the weekend that we really were coming here. And when I saw you, you came up between the races at Goodwood, I said, it is at my house, right? Because I'm not here many days, because, you know, because I live overseas. And I just thought, you know, I don't want you thinking I can go to London on the only day I've got free this week. I would have done it because I love doing the program, but I wouldn't have been as happy as I am with you coming to the sunshine of Pagham. And as Ed has said, it's sunnier here than it is in London.
I can assure you, we're all more than delighted to be out of London and down in Sussex. Fantastic. Yes, you live in Florida. That was a big decision, actually, because you're such a local boy here. You spent the whole of the rest of your life here, despite travelling around the world. But you're married to an American, of course, and that was obviously a big part of it.
Well, she didn't want... my wife, Misty, I've been with her 27 years now. I thought I married the first one for 25. That makes me about 103. But in fact, we've been together 27 years and we have a son aged 15 and we've been married 16. So it's pretty special. But the latter part of my career, unbeknown to a lot of Brits, was, of course, I was racing in America. And obviously at the ends of the Lowenbrow Porsche period, which was right up into the basically the early 90s, I stayed on doing the races at Daytona, Sebring and races like that and all around America in the 333 SP Ferraris, and I couldn't name them all. And then ultimately, of course, I was doing a lot of TV, doing the Formula One commentary for ESPN and Fox. And because of that, Roger Werner, who was the man right behind ESPN and then behind Speed Vision, he said, I think you should be driving a car and commentating from the car because you talk so much. So he didn't quite create, but they had a thing called Speed GT, which was part of the SCCA series in America and became very, very popular. And it's actually the one that I think the Bentley is running in right now in the States. And so I started off driving a BMW, which had a monumental crash when somebody hit me. And that was a great start. And I remember everybody diving to try and get extricate me from this wreck.
Where was that?
That was there? At Laguna Seca. And I came round turn three, I think it is, the right-hander, and a bloke in a Corvette who seemed to be my main problem for about 5 years. He just decided he had a great affection for taking me off the road. And he hit me, and off the road I went. Anyway, that from that on, having destroyed the BMW, they said, look, come on, let's run Audis. And so I actually ran for Champion Audi for about 5 years, which was brilliant fun in that series. But within the car, of course, I would commentate the various periods. So I had 3 to 4 cameras on the car and microphones. So I talked from the car, but we had some quite entertaining moments.
I think we should introduce that. Definitely. Absolutely. We should get Daniel Ricciardo to commentate the race from the Red Bull. Anyway, Derek... here we are.
With I was going to add, probably not Kimi. That's the only.
Probably not Kimi. No, no, probably not.
Ethical,
good
pregnant
point.
Pauses.
Well, it would be silence most of the time, and then colourful language for the other 9 seconds.
Quite. Okay. Well, I'd like to go right back to the beginning, way before being the Bentley ambassador in Florida and sports car champion and all of that. I'd like to start at the beginning because we were at the Goodwood Revival just a few days ago, and that's where you won your first ever motor race in a Lotus 7, wasn't it?
It seems terribly boring to talking about it because everybody's heard me rattle on about it before, but perhaps I haven't because it's been so long.
Well, we'll keep it brief.
Okay. Now, I'd been at agricultural college at Cirencester learning to be a farmer because we had a 500-acre farm right here. And when I sort of left and came back, I'd already been to the Jim Russell School, and Jim had picked me out as having somebody of unusual talent for some reason. But, of course, wasn't prepared to put any money in to help me go any further. So it's great. Guarantee within a year you're on a factory team. Goodbye. And although he did encourage me, and I'm sure if it had been today, I would have been in for one of those awards. Although I did come second in the Grovewood Award the next year, behind Alan Rollinson, a couple of years later anyway. And I came back to run the farm, and a guy called John Penfold came along to sell me some farm machinery, as they would. So I was age 23 by now. And we both chatted about racing, and we built a Lotus 7 together, which on March the 13th, 1964, we rolled out, having run it until about 9 o'clock the night before in the piddling rain, nearly catching pneumonia, running in without mudguards on, brought it home. John then put the mudguards on at 5 a.m. so I could have at least 3 hours sleep, took it up to Goodwood, and I won the race somehow.
You nearly won that championship. You came second in the Lotus 7 championship, and you moved on to Formula 3. I mean, that was quite a big step, actually, not only financially, but a totally, totally different car.
Well, yes, but remember, at the Jim Russell, I'd driven Formula Junior, if that's the right word, albeit Lotus 18. So I was used to sitting in a single-seater, but, you know, I was only limited to limited revs and doing a pound a lap for 10 laps. Then I came home. You know, I couldn't afford anymore. I was only earning 20 quid a week, for goodness sake. And so, but to actually get in a proper car. But really, it's like everything. I think every driver out there has to admit there was somebody along the line that helped him. You can't really do it on your own unless you've got loads of money. And my dear old stepfather, Bernard Hender, who owned the farm, who was married to my mother, the Colonel as we called him, he said he loved racing. He went all around the world racing and watching. And he said, you know, what can we do to help Derek get on? And so the guy that we'd had helping us with the Lotus 7 at the end, he said, you know, you've got to help him. Let's get a Formula 3. So we bought Rod Banting's Formula 3, which was a BMC. It was a Lotus 31 with a BMC engine. The engine actually that Jackie Stewart had raced at Goodwood that year in 64, and I then raced basically the identical car, but it was the Lotus chassis in 65. And can you believe I actually broke his lap record that next year? But we didn't shout about it because nobody knew who the hell I was. And they weren't sure even then who Jackie Stewart was. But so it goes down in the history books, which is really amusing. And I won my very first race at Mallory Park because they wouldn't accept me at Brands because I was unknown. So the Boxing Day meeting, having won at Brands at Mallory at the end of that year, 65. Where are we? 64, same year as the Lotus 7. They then invited me in 65, a month later, to drive at Brands Hatch because their race had been postponed because of snow. So I actually won my class there too. So suddenly I was sort of doing quite well, but all with this little old BMC engine thing. And then we built our own engines down here at the farm. Biggest mistake ever. Instead of buying a Cosworth engine for 600 quid, an MAE, the screaming little 1 litre cars. And I went out and started to do some British races, but of course we were completely thrashed. But it was a great learning curve.
At this point, did you have great dreams of being a Grand Prix driver? I mean, how ambitious were you?
I wasn't never very ambitious. That was one of my problems. I just wanted to race and I enjoyed it. But, you know, all I really wanted to do was to race at Goodwood. The trouble is I did that in my first race and won. Well, I was going quite well at that stage. But as I progressed, I really wanted to win a big race because I used to be a marshal for Bognor Motor Club and Chittister Motor Club up there. In fact, I was marshalling the day Stirling crashed in 62. I was marshalling at Madgwick and he crashed up the road at Fordwater. Or entering St Mary's. Sorry.
It's amazing. And I've never ever heard you say that before.
Never. You never asked
no,
me.
No. But I mean, it's just you'd think it'd be one of those things of your time I would have heard.
Yeah. No.
I'm amazed.
No, and the other amazing thing about that is the fact that this year, the gentleman that is put into compiling Maranello Concessionaire's sort of history book of souvenirs and paraphernalia and memorabilia, he sent me a photograph. And he said, who is in this picture? Who is the guy in the wheelchair? And he sent me this photograph And Sterling is pushing the wheelchair, and I am pushing the wheelchair with this handicapped gentleman in. And it was the day that Sterling crashed. And I'm pushing this, but I never even remember doing it. And it's me. I could show you the black and white picture. And of course, so I thought, my God, I've got to show Sterling, who I've got to know incredibly well, like all of us. And some weeks later, I showed him. He said, yeah, that's Mike so-and-so. He knew straight away who he was. But isn't it amazing, you know, that sort of thing, which I never knew I'd even helped Sterling. He was my hero, my idol, Sterling. I'd have done anything. I mean, that was 2 years before he even sat in a race car.
We should say, actually, we're recording this podcast on Sterling's 85th birthday. So happy birthday, Sir Sterling Moss.
Happy birthday.
Indeed. So.
Yeah,
indeed
absolutely. So. Amazing,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing that he still takes the interest he does in, you know, in everything. I mean, whatever you like to say, he doesn't have to do it. You know what I'm saying?
No.
He
absolutely.
Just has, he loves it. I mean, to see him at the weekend at Goodwood, and I mean, today he's on his way to Singapore. I mean, what a schedule he has.
I know.
You know, it just goes on, doesn't it? Yeah. But he just loves it.
Well, at Monza this year, at a cost I prefer not to think about, I bought a postcard, which doesn't sound very remarkable, a 1958 Monza postcard, but it was the second of, you remember the Race of Two Worlds when you know, the Indy Roadster?
I've got one in my photograph album I could show you tonight.
Right.
In the Indy car.
Well, whoever this man was who bought this postcard, he then went into the paddock with it, which of course you could do in those days, and every single driver in the race signed it.
Did he really? Did they really?
So all the sort of the Indy greats of the time, like Roger Ward and Jimmy Bryan, but also Sterling, Mike Hawthorn, Fangio. And I was just looking at it this morning, actually, and Sterling is the only one still with us.
Wasn't that the El Dorado special?
It was the El Dorado special, the Maserati, that's right. But you sort of think that's, how long ago now? 46 years ago?
Yes.
And he is the only one still with us. And you think what his life has, what's happened since then. I mean, he had a huge accident that very weekend, which he's always said was the one that frightened him most. Then there was Goodwood. And then at whatever he was, 80, he falls down the lift shaft. I mean, he is the most astonishing man.
Yeah, exactly.
Derek, to get back to your career, I mean, the Formula 3 did put you very much on the map, actually, didn't it? I mean, you've downplayed it a bit, but people were talking about you. They really were.
Well, without, I mean, you're talking about my early career, so I've got to talk about me. I'm very sorry. But I did the year in the Lotus 31, which was just club racing. We learnt a lot. Next year, what do we do? So Colin Chapman brought a Formula 3 car to Goodwood, a Lotus 41, later that year. And everybody was there, Pete Gethin, Piers Courage, all the young upstars, you know. And we all went to Goodwood. I got a picture of me in this green and yellow Lotus. I mean, that was enough for me. Just to drive a car in bloody Lotus colours was sufficient for me. And Peter Waugh standing by the car in the photograph I have, and off I went, did some laps. They weren't trying to find a driver. They were literally trying to sell cars. And like a mug, we went and bought it, because glamour, you have to say, Lotus always had a glamour about it. Colin Chapman, Jimmy Clark, all the people, all the colour. Brabham just didn't quite have that glamour picture. And it cost me a year, but I learned a hell of a lot. I had some awful crashes. We had more broken chassis and suspensions hanging off the wall. The car would just change directions for no trouble at all. I mean, it was just awful. I remember on a Monday morning, I get back from a race in Europe, and Team Lotus would phone me up and say, what broke this weekend? And I'd have to tell him, he said, well, we were at Clermont-Ferrand, we had something break too, look, we're fixing it. It was like that every bloody week. So, but I gained it. I didn't get hurt. I was upside down in a ditch at Caserta in Italy. I mean, the shocking incidents. I was leading at Goodwood in Formula 3, one of the last races in 66 they ever did. Suddenly the car swapped ends. I mean, no reason at all in the middle of a corner. I mean, the shock absorber had broken. But that's the way things went. So at the end of the year, it was where the hell do you go now? And really the only way was to get a Brabham, bite the bullet and get the car that wasn't as pretty. And that's what we did. And of course, I joined Peter Westbury and Mac Daghorn and the guys there, and we had Felder International Racing and Sports Car Team, and that's what we did. And again, I went out on Boxing Day Brands in 66 and won the race in dismal conditions, and I went on to win 8 Formula 3 international races during that year, which at the time was not enough because I wanted to win 9. So having said I was competitive, I just wanted to win more, and I felt I should have done. There were races others I should have done.
That was an absolutely I thought that was a wonderful era of Formula 3, yeah. The 60s. It was, and it really deserves, somebody really should write a definitive history, yeah, of that period.
It was.
Because there's so many wonderful stories, yeah, from the Continental Circus and everything else.
I mean, four abreast into Woodcote, you know, yeah, at Silverstone. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, going around Enna in Sicily, there'll be 16 in a group, four abreast, going around the lake. Because there was no sharp corner. It was just one sort of curve and then another curve and another curve. And you sat there going along. We used to put racer's tape on our noses because we had open helmets in those days. Racer's tape on our helmets under the goggles. All the suspension was covered in racer's tape because the dust, you know, the volcanic dust would actually sort of take the chrome off your wheels and suspension, let alone your nose. And we'd sit there going around at 145, 150 miles an hour looking. And you knew when you were next to an Italian, you're in trouble. You know, and you think, oh God, I hope he doesn't make a move here. How the heck we got to the end, I don't know. Anyway, but that was Formula 3.
But I remember dear old Jonathan Williams, yes, saying in that era the, yes, only thing more dangerous than the circuits was the hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, I must say I was so unbelievably lucky why I didn't end up in hospital, but we had so many crashes. But at the end of the year, and then, I mean, the final race of the year, that's right, I must tell you this because we can forget about the other great races we had. But the final race of the year was at Hockenheim. And you would remember it, Nigel, because it was called the Formula 3 World Championship. And there were each country put a team of cars in. You'll recollect it bit by bit. And so we had three British cars, and I was the British number one. Second was Charlie Lucas. And third might have been Jonathan, and I can't remember that. Might have been Pete Gethin, I can't remember. But the big problem was the Italians. And they had, the Swiss team, they had Clay Regazzoni in a techno. And you know, and Xavier Pero, they had him in the car, who wasn't that good, and I can't remember going through. And of course, not Depailler, but you had Jaboui and Josso and Belt. I mean, you can't believe it. And somehow I qualified on pole. Now, how the hell I did that at Hockenheim, because I hated the place, but I probably just didn't want to be mixed up with those prats behind me. I just don't know. Anyway, the race went on and on and on, and of course you can't do anything. You can't get away because you're just in the mob. You know, the stadium was there, but the rest was flat out all the way around, down through the east curve, no chicanes, round the end and back. Oh, God, it was a horror show.
Through the trees.
No barriers. Yeah.
Barriers. Yeah. It was unbelievable. I mean, just unbelievable. And I remember the last lap, and I think I was lying somewhere like fourth, came into the stadium, and Regazzoni, thank God, was behind. And I think I was behind Jaboui and Jusso because the Matras were really strong. Do you remember they were factory cars? And it was Regas, his techno was factory. And we came into the stadium to their right-hander, and I thought, I'm never going to win it. But you never know, you might be able to outbreak somebody or they'll outfum the last four corners. And as we went in there, Regas came in and he took me out. He just took me off the road, and I went off, spun around, and came back in on the track again. He continued down the grass to the next corner, and there he took out Jaboui on the inside, took him off the road, seriously going into the sharp left-hander, got back on the track, and took somebody else off, and he won the race. He won the race, and he went over the line with no bodywork at all on the car. So we all thought, actually, we a few expletives, but we cursed and swore and said, well, fuck at this. We looked at the pictures. He had no wing mirrors on the car, so he claimed he hadn't won because you've got to finish the race with wing mirrors. He had nothing left on the bloody car, sitting in a fresh space frame. But so Switzerland won the world championship. But that was Formula 3.
You know. God, those were the days, man.
Clay was bonkers in those days.
He was crazy.
He really was.
And then my problem was, I then went up to Formula 2 the next year, because where else do you go? I'd won eight races. If you stay where you are and you only win eight more, people are going to say, well, he's not doing very well. If you win nine, they'll say, well, so he should. And if you only win seven, he's over the hill. And Rob Widow, do you remember Robin Widows? He went on to Formula 2 that year, and he did very well. And basically, I could beat Robin on most occasions. So I thought, well, I must go up to F2. So the old man and I, we went to the bank. The old man said to me, here's the Formula 2, 3 car, two engines, because we had two MEs, the little mini trailer truck we had with the trailer on the back. He said, you can have all that, but I don't want to see you driving down the street doing coffee shops in an E-type Jag. Go racing. So, of course, I had like 7,000 quid. There was no way. But I went out And I put a deposit on two Cosworth Formula 2 engines and a Brabham Formula 2 chassis. And George Brown went down and worked at Brabham's building that chassis. So he knew of it in nut and bolt. We didn't have the money. And the old man, and I remember it was the beginning of sponsorship, right? 68. So I remember I contacted everybody I could. You know, you just write a letter and say, can you help me? I need money. Nobody bothered to reply apart from Avis. And they wrote this letter back, and inside there was a little badge, and it said, sorry, we can't help you, Mr. Bell. We try harder. And that was all I bloody got. But that was my sponsorship, okay? So we thought, what a hell of, I mean, can you physically imagine it sitting in a pack and going, where do we go? I mean, you know. So the old man said, the dear old Colonel, bless his heart, who had really now been very, totally supportive, he says, come on. So he'd already said, look, Derek, you can always come back to farming. You can't come back to racing. So let's do it properly. So off we went to the bank, the Midland Bank. And obviously we had a 500-acre farm to borrow the money against, but the old man never went in the red at all. So we borrowed 10,000 quid, and that paid for everything, and the little mini transporter. And off we went with this old trailer on the back of a transit van with Ray Wardell and George Brown. And that's how we started. We went off, and my first race was at Thruxton, I believe, and I finished third behind Beltoise and Stewart, something like that. But I know I was the first non-graded driver, because in those days, which is how I talked about the other night somewhere, I think it's vital that what was so great of those years, sorry, was that you had Formula 3, Formula 2, yeah. Formula 1.
Yeah.
And you could judge the drivers as they came up. Now you've got Mazda, Lotus, yeah. Toyota, whoever it is, all these Formula. I know you're going to say, well, there's more people out there. But there were in those days, but they all bought Formula 3s. So you had each country had its own championship. And if they were lucky, they got 60 or 80 of them to Monaco to qualify. Do you remember? And then they had to get into the qualifying at Monaco. And then they might get a race, 24 of them at the end of it. But at least you saw basically the 24 best up-and-coming drivers. Yeah. Now you don't know where the hell to go to watch it, apart from obviously the brilliant Autosport Awards and all that sure. that goes with it.
Well, the other thing too, Derek, about those days, Formula 2, an up-and-coming driver could race against the world champion.
Well, that's
so.
What I was
so that was the
to,
thing.
Yeah.
So you were able to gauge. Well, am I any good?
Yes, Jesus, that's right.
I probably am.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So I went out and I was in the ungraded section because I was an up and comer. So Beltoise had just. I think Beltoise and Stewart were obviously graded drivers. They'd been in F1. So I was the first of the non-graded drivers, and that was how it went. And Jackie Oliver, I seem to remember, was just behind me in the Works Lotus. He was fourth. And suddenly, you know, there was a championship looming for, you know, and it was brilliant. And of course, then you go to the next races at Hockenheim and Jimmy Clark dies. So that sort of put you back on your uppers, because Jimmy was the one person that I had said, well, people said, oh, but racing's dangerous. Well, we knew it was, but I said, Jimmy hasn't broken the skin on his body. And then, of course, he has his crash, and that was it. But I'd had breakfast with him that morning, you know, at the hotel. We stayed the same, and I drove to the track with Jimmy and Graham. It was amazing. And that was me, like, in awe of my two heroes. And, you know, I got out of the car at my truck, and I never saw him again. So that was the beginning of International Formula 2, and it was bloody terrifying, really.
Did it ever,
they were so fantastic to drive.
Did it ever cross your mind to stop?
Later that year, yes. But if I can just, and we're going to finish at Ferrari anyway, as you. But you know, I mean, I persevered through that year. Had some great races, and I just never forget it because Jochen Rindt was in it. Now Jochen, I thought, was one of the greatest the world had ever seen, and I used to finish second to him in Europe because the British didn't know about this because we were racing at Rouen, Reims, and all down, you know, down through Italy, Spain. But Jochen came to race because he was loved racing. Bloody frustrating because, of course, we'd be out there battling away all on a Friday, and you're going to turn up Saturday morning, go out and blow us all off, you know. I never again, he stood there in his big long trench coat having a chat and just getting the car off you go, and you go, oh, shit. You know, there he was ahead of you on the grid. He was brilliant, you know, but I'd like to think I learned a lot from him. And in fact, in the papers in France or Belgium one weekend after the race, it said Le Roi et le Dauphin, and it was Jochen and me, and because we were all, not always, but very frequently close together. But I learned such a lot. And then after four of those, I got the magic call to go to a Ferrari. But on top of that, which is really what you mentioned earlier, is that I was invited to drive for Cooper in Formula One, and Colin Chapman had asked me to drive at Silverstone when I was out there to test a sports car after Jimmy's passing. And Colin looked up and said, you're going well this year. And he asked me to go and drive the Indy car. Do you remember that? No, you don't. Well, you don't remember being asked. But that shows the press never went, you know, and normally the press would have been taking pictures of the Indy car and Graham, you know, Graham was in one car and literally.
And Spence, Mike Spence drove the
Well, that's
the
right,
other,
he drove the car. But Mike wasn't in the car at that point. And Colin said, would I shake it down for him? Then I was literally, he said to me, he said, this is in front of all these people. You're going well this year. And I went, God's talking to me, you know. So I went, so he said, and then 5 minutes later, he said, come on down. He said, have you ever driven an automatic? I said, no. He said, take my Jag out. So I went up and down the runway and I came back. He said, I can drive an automatic, Colin. I'm all right now. Don't let anybody get his foot in the door. So they stuck me in the car, helmet on. I did have a photograph. And I was sitting in this damn thing out the back of the pits. And they said, we can't let you out until Graham stops because you can't hear the cars go around. Of course, in those days, you had no marshals anywhere. You can't believe you did that, can you really? So I sat in it with it, warming it up, you know, goggles and helmet all ready to, open-faced helmet, no less, ready to go out. And of course, they come up and say, sorry, Derek, Graham's had transmission problems. He's taken your car over. So I never did get in it. But I had Cooper after me, and I had to, I'll briefly go into it because we're going to finish this era very quickly, is that I, at the same time as I had Ferrari. And also then John White came on about driving the GT40 because Le Mans was later that year. And so I had Ferrari and Cooper. Now, who would you have driven for, Cooper or Ferrari? Come on, I put you on the spot, Nigel.
Well, there was no decision to be made, was it? But particularly by 68, I mean, Cooper were essentially done, weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that they hadn't quite got out of, they hadn't quite got the new car when I got in.
Okay.
And so.
Did you actually test it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I went and had I had a test at Silverstone. And it wasn't very good. I don't know about lap times, but I wasn't totally happy in it. Remember, I hadn't driven an F1 before, but I was. But it was big. And then I went overnight to Monza. I was going to test actually the Ferrari at Crystal Palace. That's right, at Goodwood. And they said we're racing at Crystal Palace this weekend, which I was in the race. And they said, which Jackie Ickx was driving it, and I just saw this red Ferrari. I went, God, that could be me next week. You know, I mean, you can't, I mean, you're salivating, yeah, yeah, aren't you, really? So I can't remember, I didn't do a very good race. I think I was too nervous. And then Jackie crashed. So they said, sorry, no test. And I went, well, that's it then, isn't it? Cheers, I'll never get the chance. Then a week later, come to Monza. So I went to Monza and there were like 16, 14 drivers there. And some of the names carried on. I can't remember the names, I can't remember. And, you know, I got the drive. Whether I really got it, I have no idea. Whether they just liked me, but. Off I went. And the next day I went to the factory and I met the old man, which is yet another story. And I had 24 hours with him, which was phenomenal, just to meet him on his own at the Cavallino and have lunch and things like that. All he did was talk about Jochen Rindt, incidentally, which pissed me off a bit. I thought, I can't match him, sir. I'm sorry. But so I went. So then I went back and I went to Silverstone again and tested the Cooper again, ran it again. And then I was asked to go and talk about my contract. So I went with Cooper. So I remember going to this office, you know, and I remember the thing called the Mayfair scale, which I'm sure you'll remember intimately. All I know is just part of the deal that they got a certain amount of money for the certain number of points they got, probably just the same as today in a different format.
A little bit more official, yes.
So we sat there and a guy called Major Owens talked me through it. I saw the car sitting there and they said, this is the car you'll have next year. And it was only halfway built. I'm going, Christ, they're slow, aren't they? You know, but anyway, so this is the car you'll have next year. And it didn't look much different to the one I was been driving this year. And so Major Owens chatting to me in this room, you know, very formally. And I'd heard figures bandied around, but somehow £100,000 stuck in my mind as being... You know, what you got is a driver in Formula One, you see? So how wrong can you be, I thought. So we go through it, and as he talks, he's talking to me, he says, well, he said, we were part of the Mayfair scale, but he said, we've had a pretty bad year or two, and we're not part of that now, so we don't get that money coming in. So my 100 went down to 50, and it was gradually getting, so it got down to 20,000, okay, in my own mind. And he said, you know, we've got this to do. We're building new. We've got a new premises and we got this and we got that and the other. Anyway, he went down 10,000, 5,000. I thought, where the hell are we going here? He says, so I said, what are you actually offering me? And he said, let's just say £5 is a nominal amount. Seriously. I sat down, I looked at him, and I went, and of course, you know, I mean, I was a bum farmer from Pagham. What the hell did I couldn't negotiate. I'm glad I didn't have anybody to negotiate, because he might have got me 25 quid, you know, we'd have probably taken it. And I went, seriously, as true as I'm sitting here, and they could never refute it. And I went, and I thought, he said, but, so I said, well, I'll have to think about that one. So I left, and I went back to Ferrari the next day, went down to Modena again to sort of supposedly sign my contract. And I got down there. But meanwhile, my wife at that time was terribly ill in hospital here with a thing called colitis, bloody ill. And of course, I was getting hell of a stick from the family because you know, she was ill in hospital. It was an emotional thing. Lots of our friends had been hurt in racing. And I was making it worse by joining Ferrari. So the degree that when I walked in my parents' house over the road on the farm, the next day when I came back down, my mother stood there with my mother-in-law, both with a couple of gin and tonics at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, half a gallon each. They both drank for the county, my mother for Sussex and my wife's mother for Leicestershire. And they're surfing on their gin and tonics. And as they walk in, they said, you have got a telegram here from Ferrari. I said, all right. And they said, it says, would you please come to Modena and sign your contract? And they both looked at me in the clank glasses, if you sign that contract, you'll never walk in this house again. And nobody knows all this stuff. So you're hearing it for the first time. And I went, oh my God. So what am I? I mean, I was on such a big high. I had all these people wanting me to drive, and I was like that. Meanwhile, my dear wife, Pam, at that time was in hospital, and I thought she was very ill. And I thought, oh God. So I thought, but you know, I went to see her that night. And so she said, hello. And she was bubbling because she was feeling better, you know, but wasn't well. And she said, how did it go at Ferrari? I said, great. I said, they've offered me a contract. She said, brilliant. When are you going to sign it? And I thought, to my parents. And so I went home, and I never talked about it again. And they never brought it up ever again.
Really?
But I went down to race then in the Formula 2 race at Monza in the Lotteria. The Lotteria. And I got pole position. I'm sure these are all fixed. But I got pole in a Ferrari. And there were four Ferraris in the race. And all these young aspiring Italian blokes. Well, of course, the Ferrari was great if you keep the speed going, a bit like the 312, but you couldn't do anything in a mob because you didn't have any torque. So to cut a long story short, I ended up being about lying eighth or something, going through the parabolica, and I got hit up the tail by somebody. I was told, I think something broke, but whatever. And I spun around, and my own Brabham, which Peter Westbury was driving, crashed, and two of the Ferraris. I took the whole Ferrari team out.
It was a huge
crash. Through the air,
that's right.
Dropped out of the car. The car exploded. Oh my God, he broke his ankle or whatever. It was awful. And of course, I thought, well, that's it, because I hadn't signed my contract, because I wasn't actually very happy about Ferrari, because I'd heard so many bad stories. So I thought that was it. They gave me my money, 250 quid. And I jumped on a plane and came home to England. And my wife, Pamela, at that time, was in hospital, and they had it on bloody 9 o'clock news. Anyway, she wasn't over the moon about that either. But she was all right. And then I thought, that's it then. I'll never hear any more. And then 3 days later, telex comes through Keith Ballisat at Shell. He's all went through Keith. And it said, please come out to Modena to sign your contract. I thought, shit, I've done it. Get pole, wreck three Ferraris, and they still want me. I must be one of their boys.
Well, because the old man always loved drama, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't have a quiet debut, did you?
No. I told them I was around. And so that was it. So you can imagine, I was on that next plane to Milan and picked up my rental car, which is what we had to do, a little Fiat 124, off down to Maranello. And I walked in the office. And as I walked in the office, Mr. Gozzi, who was his right-hand man and looked after us all, never quite sure what he did, but that was his job. And as I walked in the office, he said, Derek, that was wonderful. And
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Commander Tory was so happy with you getting pole position. Here you are, and he gave me a check for $1,000 for wrecking three Ferraris.
Bizarre.
And getting pole position.
Totally bizarre.
And he said, here's your contract. I've never signed a contract so fast in my life, actually. And that was it.
Actually, Derek, we've got a question. We've got a question from one of our listeners who says, what do you think of what's going on at Ferrari at the moment? More sort of Machiavellian politics. I mean, it's the same story in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because although we got much more information these days, we actually haven't. because so much is going on down there that you don't know. I think it's awful when they rock the boat the way they do. I can't believe that, I can't believe that Montezemolo has done a bad job. I don't think he's obviously up there in a pretty important elevated position, probably above what he should be at. But I think if he'd been probably left to run Ferrari instead of get a major player at Fiat, he might have been able to do more with the team. But I thought, I mean, he came all the way through, don't forget, with Enzo. I mean, I guess he was there when I was there, but I didn't remember meeting him. But I just think, you know, the way they rocked the boat in the middle of the season and even the fact they brought in the new team manager, who I met, Mr. Mattiacci. I met him in a Daytona this year at the 24 Hour. And he was the head of Ferrari USA. And as much as I thought he was a pleasant man, when you suddenly hear he's going to run the Ferrari team, you go, where did he come from to do that? And they used to do that. You remember Franco Lini was the team manager. Yeah,
he did know a lot about racing. He just but mainly about writing about it. That was the thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he talked a lot.
Oh, he wrote a lot. Talked a lot.
And yeah. So he ends up being the team manager at Ferrari. You know, and I honestly don't know what to say. All I know is that you've got, and I think this is the same with every team, and I don't agree with lots of the stuff that's going on in Formula One. I feel sorry for the drivers in many, many ways, is that I think you have to have a good feeling amongst the teams. That each team has to have its own, the drivers have to get on, the mechanics. How can you possibly have two businesses doing the same thing and they're fighting each other when they should actually be pooling all their resources to get the best result? I mean, the teams that have a good rapport between the drivers, they're probably doing quite well. You know, I mean, who knows what's happening at Red Bull right now? I don't know. I'm sure Vettel isn't happy with Ricciardo going on, and none of us would be. But I feel that I think there has to be even the stuff at McLaren and at Mercedes. I think it's not McLaren, it's Mercedes, isn't it, we're talking about. I mean, I feel sorry for what's going on for the drivers, because they just want to drive. And I remember Dave Coulthard saying one day, he's like, God, once that flag drops, at least we can be ourselves. But actually, they can't anymore, because they're being told every minute, go a bit faster. To have a bloke that's never driven a race car in his life telling you to go faster is a bloody joke.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in fact, this has been a great turn-off for the public. The drivers literally, it's almost like driving by numbers, instructions from the race engineers all the time. But that is now being curtailed.
Yes,
by the,
exactly.
So for once, it seems as though they are listening to, you know, what the fans like and don't like, which is a good step.
I just think the drivers... The point is, I look at it this way, and I've said this on a few things this year. The word is racing driver. Now, what does that really mean? It means we get out there and we race. So give the guy a car, make it as good as you can, and let them bloody race. And I still can't quite understand the different types of tyres, because I don't see how mum and dad at home or with the boys taking them to the races can totally understand, because they don't know in the crowd that they've changed from a red to a white or whatever colour tyre.
It's become too complicated.
Yeah, I think, and it's done it in sports car too, and they're even doing a lot worse, I think. And can't we have two sets of tyres? They're identical. You know, you have two, they're, you know, mediums or the teams can choose the two. There's two types of tyre. They can choose them, but they have to run them the whole race, you know, because they did well in qualifying, or the same for everybody, if you like. But make it more simple for the public. What is the advantage of having different tyres? You know, we're in entertainment. We're not out there to prove how wonderful Pirelli can build a softer tyre to last 8 laps than another one to do to 38. We're out there to race cars. And I've talked to one driver, and he just says, all I want to do is race. And you get into the sport, the new sports car rules. And as much as I think it's great to see what they're doing, we have to do the bit for the environment and all the rest of it. When you hear a driver, and I can tell you, I wouldn't tell you his name, he said to me, we actually have to back off because it tells us in the cockpit that we're using too much fuel in the middle of a lap. I mean, is that really racing? Well,
somebody got a penalty in Beijing in the Formula E race for using too much battery.
Yep.
I mean, that's thought you were going to say someone got a penalty in the Formula E race for going too quickly. I noticed Dario Franchitti was doing the commentary, and when I see him, I must congratulate him for keeping awake to the end of the race.
Really? Was it Paul?
Anyway.
It was slow, Derek.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
And changing cars in the middle of the race is something else.
Yes, this is very odd. I'm going to have to move us along, I'm afraid, because we've got questions from our listeners.
And, sorry, Rob. Forgive me.
Derek, Will Dale wants you to say a bit about Stefan Beloff, because obviously huge, huge, huge potential, and you drove with him, you raced with him.
Yeah, and I got to know his father really well, and he calls Sebastian my son when he meets him. It's really sweet. And we've been with him last year at the laps we did at the Nürburgring, and then this year he came again to when we were signing autographs, and he gave me a beautiful book that they had done about Stefan in pictorial. You know, yeah, I've got it here, I'll show you. I've still got it. I might have, unless I took it to States. And it was, he was just raw talent. Totally raw talent. I mean, he was bloody quick. All he knew was how to race, okay, flat out. Which again, almost, if he'd been out there now, he would have shot himself, because at least he could go flat out. The big disadvantage of Stefan is when I took the car over, they'd call me up and say, turn the boost down, turn this down, because he's used all the bloody fuel. But seriously, and people would watch me droning around going, Bell's out of it, he's really had it, isn't he? You say, thanks a lot, you know. But he was outstanding, and he was obviously quicker than me. But not all the time, but over an hour we were pretty bloody comparable. But he was just a raw talent, and he was such a nice kid. You know, he was, I didn't know him in Formula One terms, but I knew him obviously when he was racing in F1, but he was racing with me too. And he was just a fabulous person, young, and just let it all hang out. My disappointment is, and it's actually in his book, although it's written in German, and I express my feelings that he should have been taken in hand by somebody along the line, whether it be Ken Tyrrell, who actually, I have to say, I thought might have done more with him. And when he left Porsche to go to Ken, I thought, good, maybe they'll get hold of him. Ken will get hold of him and mature him very quickly into a great talent. I mean, he'd handled Jackie Stewart, obviously was a great talent. He'd handled Francois Sever. And I thought that he would be able to do the same for Stefan.
And he calmed down Jody, didn't he, for that matter?
Ken, well, there you are. I'd never thought of that side of it. But yes, you're right. And I thought he'd do it. And I think I remember one of the, I perhaps shouldn't say it, but I've said it in books, but we were at the Nürburgring. And we were leading by quite a, you know, like two laps or something ridiculous, or a lap or half a lap, whatever it was, several minutes. I mean, even Ayrton Senna wasn't on the same lap in the Yost car, you know, three or four back. And we're leading. I'd done my bit. He'd done his bit. And Stefan was in there driving. And he started to click off lap after lap, sort of 3 seconds a lap coming off the top, which was brilliant. But we were well in the lead. Now, in the John Wire days, they'd have put a board out saying, okay, kid, we're okay. So hang in there, you know, don't. Let's not push it anymore. And I walked up to one of the leading players at Porsche, and I said, wouldn't it be a good idea just to sort of put a hold, take it easy, board out, or good stuff? And he said, no, isn't he wonderful? And he never came round again. And he stuffed it. Now, he didn't get hurt that time. He destroyed the car. But I'd never won at the ring, and I was desperate to win. But it shows that I think he should have been controlled, because he could have so easily had a fatal accident that day when you think where he went off. And of course, he did it the next year. And I think his accident was basically totally unnecessary. A very silly place to try and overtake a number one driver next, you know, and overtake Jackie. I mean, what a bloody place to do it when it's a flat out corner. I don't understand that. But as a talent, he was amazing. And I'm just, it's tragic that he's gone, because to me, he probably was the quickest they ever had in Germany. I don't know. Sorry, you were going to say
no,
something?
No,
I was just going to say, I look back and I think of him as the great unrealized talent. in Formula One.
Yeah.
Derek, there's a question from, his name is Frederico Pinheiro de Mello. We have listeners all over the world.
He's not from Pagham, is he?
He's not from Pagham. He's not from Pagham, Derek. He wants you to talk a little bit about the 917 and the 512, obviously, the Porsche and the Ferrari. Mm. I guess there was really no comparison, or could you? I mean, the 917 was a better car, yes? Or?
Well, basically 512 and then the 917, because the first my first ever sports car race was Spa in the 512. And I mean, fancy going to Spa for the first time in a 512. Because I say to all the young guys today, look, go there in something small like a 2 liter Lola or a Chevron or a saloon car and learn the tracks in something sort of insignificant. Anyway, and so I drove the.
You're saying you hadn't seen Spa till you went in a.
No.
And this is old Spa.
This is old Spa, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? But, you know, we didn't think. We just drove, didn't we? That's where we went. I mean, you know, you got Formula One pictures going around, you know, Monza, and there's pictures. I got one in the study there, and all you can see is grass and trees, and I've got the tail out going through a van. I mean, it was like that, though, wasn't it? But anyway, I'm not saying, oh, weren't we wonderful? We were just bloody stupid, to be honest, because we just did it. But if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have done it.
Well, it's true, but I mean, that's the way it was. I mean, you'd nothing to compare it with. No. It wasn't as though you were comparing it with now and thinking, crisis is dangerous. Yeah, I mean, it was dangerous, and it had always been.
That's right. But we basically drove within it. So, but the 512 was actually very good for Spa, because the 512 always understeered, and it didn't have that much power, but it was quick. I mean, we were all running near the front. My teammate was a tad slow, like 24 seconds a lap slower at that point, but it didn't really matter. And we had a couple of fires just to sort of aid the situation in the car. And literally three times I got back and, okay, the car's okay now, because we're on the hill. Do you remember at Spa? Yeah. Came in for fuel, and I'm sitting there, turned the gear, and it just exploded. And of course, so I thought, oh, to hell. So the mechanic actually threw the fire extinguisher, because the handle had broken on my door. So he threw the fire extinguisher through the door and pulled and helped me get out. And I leapt out, and I got my face burnt. I really did, but not enough to go to hospital. So I got out, and they said, okay, they whopped all the fuel up. Fuel's running down from the car 20 pits further up, pissing down the gully. You know, they're tipping gallons, churns of fuel, and it's coming down under my car, you know. So, because every time there's a spark from the starter, up it blows. So it happened three times, and the fourth time I was getting wise, because I'm very intelligent. And so the fourth time I actually put my leg inside the cockpit like that, ready, and I sort of, obviously, and I leant in, the door was up my head, and I put my leg in, and I turned the key, you know, and waited for the explosion. And it started up, and it's all right then, chonk, 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 chonk. So I got in, and off I went with no window and a burnt face. But apart from that, it was good. And from that, Mr. Ferrari was impressed, because I got the call to go back to Ferrari for Le Mans. Well, as a works driver. So I went back and drove the works Ferrari with Ronnie Peterson at Le Mans. And it was, but we're not going into that. But then from that, I went on to John Wire, who'd been on to me back in 68 about driving the GT40 with Pedro, which I couldn't take because Mr. Ferrari pointed out I had a contract with him. And so I couldn't drive for GT40, even though Ferrari weren't there back in 68. So that was it. And so I went to, I had to test drive at Goodwood and with Ronnie Peterson and Peter Gethin. Goodwood, I mean, why they brought it Goodwood, I guess because John Wire found it easier to come here, and it suited me, although I didn't know it that well. I mean, I was still pretty young. But I somehow got the drive. I think it was really because Ronnie had to concentrate on Formula One, because I thought he was an outstanding driver. But basically, the Porsche was just a newer update. It was a better version of 512. I mean, if you drive the later Ferraris, which I didn't, they were a lot better. That early one was a bit truck-like. But the 917, just more compliant. It just did everything better.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. We could talk all day, but we have to move on. Cameron McCauley, Derek, says that he thinks that he remembers that you were having dinner with Hans Stuck when you were told you'd won the World Endurance Championship in 85. He wants to know if this is true. Maybe you don't remember either, actually.
85 and 86, right? 85, we won outright. 86... For 86, obviously Porsche were pretty keen for Stuckey to win the world championship. Stuckey was doing that Interserie, and they had a very special lightweight super duper Group C car without any heavyweight stuff in it. you know, one pump instead of four, and everything lightweight. And it was gorgeous, you know, made of all special materials. We went to Norris Ring, and at that point, Stucky and I were on equal points because we'd been driving together all year. So we get to Norris Ring, and or we don't. I'm not going to Norris Ring, and John Fitzpatrick, bless him, phones me up. He says, "Would you drive my Goodyear shod J. David car?" He said, "It's on Goodyear tyres. I'm sorry, it's not as good, you know, as the other tyres, but, you know, it's going to give you a chance to get a few points." And it was really bloody nice of him. He probably got start money, but whatever it was, I did it because I needed to be there. So I go out and I qualify like 12th. I mean, I really wasn't in the hunt at all in this dear old thing. So we're all there. And of course, you know, we're racing for a German guy to win this race. So the race starts and off goes Stucky. I'm depressed, blaming everything but myself. And I go off and trolling around. And after like, it's about 50 lap race. And after, you know, 20 laps, I'm sort of lying 12th and Stucky's leading. And then I come by the pits. And as I go by, I see this big crowd of people in one of the pits. So as you go storming by, I went, "That's the Porsche pit." Next lap round, I go by, "That's the Porsche pit." And I went, "Bloody hell, that's Stucky's pit." So anyway, I did this about 8 times. And every time he's there, and I was going, "Great, you know, great." But I knew it wasn't really helping me anything at all. So that's how I finished way ahead of him. In fact, I was 12th and he was 13th. So that was that. So we then carry on the rest of the year driving together, getting points together. And it comes to the last race at Suzuka or Fuji, one of the two. And we had some problems there. I think we didn't go very well. Stucky got hit by a slower car early on in the race, went in the pits and had to change some of the bodywork. Carried on, and we actually had to beat Derek Warwick in the works Jaguar. But we had to finish. If we finished ahead of fourth, we were going to win. Anyway, so that was it. And we weren't going to finish above fourth place. So we were going to be, you know, further in the... We're not going to beat the Jag. And so after the race, we're all back at the hotel, all depressed and everything. And Norbert Singer comes, walks in. Stucken actually standing in the foyer. And Norbert Singer walks in and he says, "Herr Bell, very congratulations." So I said, "What for?" He said, "You've won the world championship." I said, "Well, how did that happen?" So he said, "Well," he said, "first of all, the Jaguar was found to have missed a lap or something incorrect scoring, so you finished ahead of it." And he said, and I said, "Yeah, but that makes Stucky the champion." "No, no," he said. "Do you remember that day at Norris Ring when you finished 12th? And I beat him by a 12th over a 13th position." So that was it.
Good story. I like
great.
It. Good question, Cameron. Derek, would you, Neil Kirby wants to know whether you think that your 81 Le Mans victory with Jackie Eakes in the 936 was your most perfect drive of all your amazing sports car victories?
At Le Mans, I assume you mean. Yeah. There were some other ones that were better than that, but I think. But I mean, the whole, I couldn't tell you one win from another. I remember when we won in the Mirage, but once you started winning in the Porsches, and the 936 I can remember vividly, actually having said that, because it was a different sort of car. I wasn't driving it until the last minute, and because I meant to drive another car with Steve O'Rourke, and he very kindly released me. And I went and drove the car. I mean, I hadn't sat in it until we got to Le Mans. I did the fastest lap I'd ever done in my life around Le Mans in my first session, which is irrelevant really, but it meant I felt at home in it. And, you know, here I was driving a real proper racing Porsche, and we had no problems, and we led basically from start to finish. So it was a perfect race, and there was nothing wrong the whole race with either of us. And I, you know, driving with Jackie was just such an amazing experience because he didn't put a foot wrong, and he brought the best out in me, and I didn't either. And we never came in with grazes on the car, or, I mean, I don't remember any of us, I mean, really spinning of our own. We never did anything wrong of our own accord. He was just the most perfect guy to guide you, and that's what I had hoped to be doing with Stefan Beloff, and I did with Stucky, was to make them a bit more reason. But they, you know, we were all older than Beloff going back to that scenario. But I think the 936, yes, was magnificent, but it was a big surprise. I mean, that was never meant to be there. So yeah, I mean, that was a great race, but I don't know if it was the most. We had some super races with the 962s,
so many of them.
There were three more, you see, but
I must ask you, Seeing you at the Goodwood Revival and listening to you talking today about those Formula 3 days when, you know, it really was very, very dangerous indeed. It's amazing what you've done, where you've been, what you've achieved, and there you are still standing at Goodwood where it all started. I mean, you must sometimes think, you know...
Yes, I do. Quite often think. No, I know what you mean. No, you do. I mean, you I do. It concerns me. And that's why sometimes when you get in a car that isn't very good or has a problem, you do think, what the hell am I doing? But not only that, I mean, all the years I was out there and all the guys I raced against, and I'm still able to go out and drive moderately well. And, you know, I had a really good race in that Jaguar D-Type and finished fourth. And, you know, I had a smaller engine than all the guys around me. They had 3.8s, I had a 3.4. And I felt so at home. I got out grinning every time because it was such a bloody beautiful car.
Had you driven a D-Type before?
I drove one 6 or 7 years ago, the one that Nigel Webb owns. And I actually didn't like it. And I wasn't very good in it. I didn't like the feeling of it. Now, this one is basically the same, but it's probably set up differently. And from the moment I sat in it, when we did a sort of 20-lap test a week before, I felt at home. I mean, I got away grinning, and I'm going, why do I like this so much? And we used to say, if you're still smiling, then you ain't going quick enough. And I didn't really know until I got out for official practice, because we didn't have any watches on those test days. And only when I got out there officially and was sort of running in the top four did I realize that obviously I was actually going quite well. And, you know, I mean, the car was just bloody gorgeous to drive, to be honest.
Right, it was towards the end, Nigel Roebuck, our Grand Prix writer and our editor-in-chief, of course, of Motorsport magazine. You've known Derek a long time. Looking back at Formula One when he was with Ferrari, not much has really changed. I mean, apart from the technology, it still seems the same kind of place, doesn't it? Do you think, I know you're a big fan of Alonso, do you think that he will stay with Ferrari, or do you think he'll go?
Well, Fernando, well, next year. I don't think he's going anywhere next year. I think he'd be mad to go anywhere next year, quite honestly. This will be James Allison's first true car, and he's got a lot of faith in him. Things are in a bit of a state at the moment. There's a lot of upheaval and whatnot, but changes are being made. And you'd have to say, for as far as Alonso's concerned, he's going to welcome change, isn't he? Because he's wasted the five best years of his career. Mm. You know, if we're going to be honest about it. But I can't see why would he go to McLaren, for instance, with a Honda engine in his first season. McLaren not exactly on the crest of a wave at the moment, so. His contract has one more year to run, and I would have thought certainly he's going to be there next year and then take another look at it. The thing about Lonzo is fortunate. He's in a position that there isn't much alternative for him at the moment. Yeah. But come the end of next year, nobody's going to sign anybody until they know what Fernando's doing. Sure. He's in a very fortunate position with that.
The great thing about Ferrari, even going, which I can see even today, is Ferrari are totally unique. And when you're part of that team, it is an amazing relationship that you'll never get anywhere else. And I think that, you know, with the talent he has, he is just, to me, the most talented one out there, I believe. All-round talent. He always puts on an amazing performance. And he drives the car to the end of the world to make it win. And when eventually, surely to goodness, they're going to have to give him a car that will do the job. Because how can he and also he's the number one there. They might not say it, but he is. And wherever else he goes, who the heck are they going to throw out at whichever team to put Alonso in there? And he doesn't want to go as an equal. And I think one of Ferrari's great assets is that they really don't have two number ones. Now, nearly every other team, there's punch-ups going on because they both think they're number ones. And I think where he is now, although Raikkonen's a brilliant talent, in my opinion, but he's been out those years and he's just not quite up to par for whatever reason.
No, I agree. But actually, Derek, just while I think of it, there is something I wanted to ask you. When you drove, I remember the first time I saw you in a Ferrari was actually the Gold Cup in 68. And then you did Monza, which must have been something else.
First Grand Prix.
Well, it was a first Grand Prix at Monza in a Ferrari.
I know. Can you imagine it?
No, I can't. I can't imagine what the pressure was like.
It was unbelievable. I have to say, it was unbelievable. I didn't sleep a wink the night before. We were staying at the Santa Storgia, and the bloody clock rings every hour. And I heard every bell all the way till 7:30 in the morning. I mean, it was horrible. But, you know, just saying, well, I'm fit and well, and I'll do it. But I tell you what, I've still got a picture now of me sitting on the grid, but standing, waiting by the car at the beginning, and I'm going, it really doesn't change. You've got the team manager, and you've got a couple of mechanics. You're standing on the grid, a couple of photographers, and you're getting in a Formula One Ferrari for your first Grand Prix. And you're at Monza in a Ferrari. I mean, my first race, remember, had been in a Ferrari in Formula 2. My first race with Ferrari had been there. So I, in a way, I got over the aura of being part of a Ferrari team at Monza. But going back in, you know, at that level, and I was on the third row of the grid, you know, so I wasn't that far back. But I was pissed off because I wasn't on the second row. And Jackie Ickx was, you know. But when you think I was next to Stewart and Halm on the third, I guess you're okay with it. But I wasn't really satisfied. But that feeling of Monza and the atmosphere, just as you drive through the park to go in, and you go in that old stadium with the old rusty old catch fencing around, was unreal.
Brian Redman once said to me, when he had a Ferrari offer at one stage, he said that he just said to himself, I've just got a feeling if I take this, I'll be dead within a year. Mm. So, I mean, that's, you know, it was very sort of rational. Why he felt that, I don't know. But bearing in mind what 68 was like, I mean, it was an atrocious year, beginning with Jimmy Clark. Mm. I remember you telling me after you stopped out on the circuit, didn't you? And then you walked back and you saw Chris Amon go over the fence.
Over the backwards, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I just wondered what effect, did you start to think, is this all never going to stop?
Well, you're absolutely right, and you actually asked me in the beginning, Rob, but I didn't, as usual, get to the end of the question. But literally, when Chris spun off and hit that guardrail and went over backwards, and the car turning upside down as it went through the trees, because I was going through the fence where he cracked, walking in, out, walking into the infield, and I saw him go back, and I went, that's it. I had to be dead. And I thought I could go back and tell my kids, Justin particularly, I could tell Justin that your dad got into Formula One in a year. He did the Italian Grand Prix, qualified in the top second, whatever third row is, and stopped racing. I was all going to quit. At that moment, I was going to quit. And then Chris, thank God, the next minute we're all watching, and I was never one that wanted to run in to see if anybody was all right, because he was the other side of the guardrail and there's bloody cars whistling through. And eventually Chris walks up the bank and he's hitting and he's dusting the dust off himself. He says, shit, that was close. I said, but it went over the top backwards. He said, oh, it landed on its wheels. And we got to the factory the next day. I got to the factory the next morning to see the car, and it had just a minor kink in the monocoque. You could have raced it. Yeah. Blasted, unbelievable. And then we jumped in the car and drove down to Bellari Adriatico and had lunch with Mr. Ferrari. If you were invited to lunch on the Sunday, it meant you were going to get a contract for the next year. So Chris and I drove down his Alfa Romeo, because we didn't have Ferraris pouring out of our ears then. And that was it. Yeah. So I stayed at Ferrari, and here I am today somehow.
But in 69, when they came back to sports car racing, why were you not involved in that sports car? Because it was a gorgeous car. Do you remember? Yeah. It was a beautiful looking thing.
Yes,
but you never drove it.
I didn't. Was that the 3-litre one, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, I'd seen the hill climb car. But I stopped racing for them in June, when the three of us were on the back of the grid. Me, Regazzoni, and Brambilla were on the back two rows at Thruxton in Formula 2. And that's how the season started, like that. We end up going to Monza for the Lotteria in June. And again, we're at the back of the grid. And we couldn't get near the lap times we'd done the year before, the same drivers. And you thought, there is something really wrong here. But remember, they had been on the Temperata series in January that year and had dominated it. But what size engine was it?
That's always been open to question.
That was D'Adamich, wasn't it?
D'Adamich and Brambilla.
Brambilla, yes.
And because I drove the engine on the Tasman series, the same engine, which actually was a 1.6 Dino engine. And I drove the identical engine on the Tasman as a 2.4. And Formula 2, of course, was 1.6.
Yeah.
And they went off and beat all the Cosworths.
And never did it again.
Never did it again. I mean, if the car had been that good, why didn't come back and us be on the front row at Thruxton? We should have been there the whole year. So I really don't know. But to answer the question about the sports car, because as usual I've gone off at a tangent, I never went to the factory after that. because, you know, we weren't going anywhere, so I didn't have to go. I was living in England.
Well, the other thing was you did the international trophy in 69.
Yeah, we finished 9th and 10th.
In terrible rain. Yeah. But then they decided they were only going to run one car.
And they hardly did that. That was with Pedro.
They had Pedro occasionally.
And the Americans put the money in for that. The literal words were, "We're pulling out of racing." And because of that, I remember I got that call from Bruce McLaren, "Would you come and drive the four-wheel drive in the British Grand Prix?" Which I did, and Ferrari was quite happy with it.
Yeah.
Year before, they wouldn't have done.
No.
And they didn't stand in my way. I didn't know there was a sports car of any description apart from the hill climb car, which I'd seen Peter Shetty drove. And that's the only sports car I ever saw. And then, of course, you know, next year up they come with a 512 and I end up back in the factory team for Le Mans.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unfathomable,
really, looking back on it, how the old man operated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, let's just take one final question. And I think this really has to be the end, sadly. And I'm not even sure I can pronounce his name, but it looks to me like Hoyvej Rodič. Who is or was, Derek, the most significant person in your career? Would you pick a person who really was a pivotal? Tricky.
I mean, it's not that. There were two people. One was the colonel, because without him...
That's your stepfather.
My stepfather, who I could never have gone on without him. It makes me wonder what I would ever have done. And to be honest, the other was Tom Wheatcroft, when he helped me with my Formula 2 program, because I met him on the Tasman in the Dino Ferrari, and he said, "Hello, lad, if I can ever help you, I'll help you." Well, of course, I got dumped by Ferrari 6 months later. Well, we all did, basically, apart from... we all did. And at that point, of course, I went to Tom and said, "Hey, you remember what you said, Tom?" He said, "Yeah, come on then." And so we ran a Formula 2 car, which made me basically... I won races in that Formula 2 car against everybody, which was fantastic, and that BT30 and the orange Brabham.
Didn't you win a race at Barcelona?
Yeah, the Grand Prix. And again, I'm blowing my own trumpet, because there's a couple of races. That, I think, was the best driver, probably, of certainly my single-seater career. The one that gave me most satisfaction. And I got pole position. I led every lap. And according to the sheets, I got fastest lap every lap. And I had people like Sever and, I mean, Ronnie P. Everybody was behind me. And on the winner's rostrum, there was me, and Emerson was second. And I think Pescarolo was third. I mean, everybody was in it. And that car was bloody perfect that day. It just did everything I wanted. That was it. Yeah, but I had some other good races.
And what a marvellous circuit.
Oh, what a track.
Jesus,
I know.
It was wonderful,
yes,
wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. Yes.
Fantastic stories. Absolutely wonderful. We could be here till the weekend, but I'm sure Derek's got plenty of other things he needs to do. It's been great. It's been great to be back at Church Farm, I must say. The old days of Church Farm racing. And I'm actually off to see Mike Earle in a few minutes' time about something completely different. So the whole motor racing fraternity, still here, apart from, sadly, poor David Purley. Otherwise, great stuff. Thank you very much, Derek. Been great to see you, and I hope we'll see you next year at Goodwood.
Oh, good Lord, that's a long way, but thank you very much. Yeah,
thank you very, very much, and thank you, Nigel Roebuck, and thank you to Ed Foster, our website editor, who has been controlling the recording today in the absence of Alan Hyde. So thanks very much, Ed, and we'll see you all next time. Our next Motorsport Magazine podcast will be with Jonathan Palmer at the end of October. We'll be going to Brands Hatch to see Jonathan, and I very much hope you'll all join us again for that. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.